Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome one and all to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, you know, yesterday we were really kind of using the sliding scale on a good martini, but today I think we actually have one, although, once again, the underlying story, not all that great given what could potentially be going on here. But it results from the Fast and Furious investigation by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, led by California Congressman Daryl Issa. He's been looking into this a great deal, and even had testimony already from Attorney General Eric Holder, who contended earlier this year that just for the past few weeks he had only known about this gun-running scheme to Mexican drug cartels, the government forcing gun shop owners to basically abandon their security principles and not running background checks. Just let the guns go. We're going to track them and we're going to bust these cartels. Well, as most people know by now, especially if you listen to anything other than the mainstream media, that at least one of those guns was used in the murder of a U.S. Border Patrol agent. Other guns have been found at various other murders. There was just another stash of 100 of them found at a drug cartel house in Mexico. And Eric Holder is trying to stonewall as much as possible, but Daryl Issa, having none of it, issuing a subpoena to Eric Holder to appear once before the committee, to explain why he basically lied the last time. Good for Daryl Issa and good for this committee for finally getting, hopefully, to the bottom of this.
Yeah, Greg, I had a chance to talk about this with my friend Cam Edwards on Cam & Company last night. And NRA News, they've been following this story extraordinarily closely. Two thoughts are going to come out of this. One is the list of documents requests from Issa was unbelievably specific, which seems to suggest they have at least some sense of where the good stuff is, so to speak. Where, you know, that they have some sense of when the key communications were going on about Fast and Furious, and where I think you're probably most likely to find contradictions with the testimony from Holder, et cetera. Also, intriguingly, they wanted to know about preparation for an interview Obama did with, I want to say, Univision very early on in this, suggesting that at some point there may have been advice to the president to not say anything about this issue, which, by the way, is a really huge south of the border, this is considered Watergate. This is considered a huge epic story, which makes it even more surprising that this gets so little attention in the U.S. press. Because of that, my guess is that at some point Barack Obama will invoke executive privilege on those documents and on documents regarding the advice to him from advisors. That kind of fits within the traditional definition of executive privilege. The interesting thing will be, does Obama try to apply that a lot further to a lot of the communications with Eric Holder? And either way, at some point in the not-too-distant future, we will get the headline, Barack Obama invokes executive privilege over Fast and Furious. And at which point I would say, hey, let the Nixon comparisons commence or accelerate in this case. So some interesting stuff coming down the pike on that. What's really kind of intriguing is during our discussion last night, we kind of realized, let's assume that you could prove beyond any reasonable doubt that Eric Holder lied to Congress about when he was informed of this. And perhaps you could see a resignation, but I don't think most people really expect that. Certainly Obama's never going to, you know, do much to hold Holder accountable on this. And, you know, we know that if, presuming Barack Obama loses in 2012, sometime between Election Day 2012 and January 20th, 2013, there will be some sort of pardon for Eric Holder in all of his activities related to Fast and Furious. Greg, would you have any doubt of that whatsoever?
No, I was thinking you were going to be predicting a shredding party at the Justice Department over those couple of months, because I'm pretty sure
that's
starting
now. I think that's, you know, if it hasn't happened already. But, you know, regarding that, so in a way, what's kind of interesting, all these folks who are crusading for the truth, the good reporters actually at CBS of all places and all these other folks, people who want to get answers, they know that in the end, the people who we strongly suspect are directly responsible or you know, who with whom the buck stops will never be held responsible. This is now solely in dedication of the truth and figuring out how this happened and who signed off on it and who authorized it. The slain U.S. Border Patrol officers deserve that. Those who have been slain and injured by these guns getting in the hands of the cartels, they deserve that. It says something about how low the bar has gotten. We kind of know deep down nobody's really going to pay a price for this. But even, you know, even with that caveat in mind, the Obama administration doesn't believe we're entitled to know what the heck happened here.
Yeah, it's one of the old conundrums. Basically, either Eric Holder knew and what in the heck were you thinking, or he didn't know and how do you not know something like this that's international going on in your own Justice Department? Either way, he's completely derelict, if not criminal, in his activities. And again, kudos to the committee for putting this front and center. And hopefully somebody besides us will cover it, although we will definitely continue to cover it diligently. On to martini number two now, and this could almost qualify for crazy, Jim, but it hasn't actually been made official yet, so we'll keep it in the bad column for now. And that's that thanks to the state of Florida deciding to jump the line on the presidential primaries and caucuses next year, there's been this whole domino effect of South Carolina and Nevada and Iowa jumping even earlier in line. And now New Hampshire is saying, no, January 7th isn't good enough for us. It's too soon after the Iowa caucuses on January 3rd. And even though we demand a 7-day bubble between us and the next contest, we don't want to shoehorn it in there between Iowa and Nevada. So now they're thinking December 6th for the New Hampshire primary. And the only thing I can think that this might work out well for is if we can get this domino effect to keep going, I'm pretty sure Michelle Bachmann is going to lobby for the results of the Iowa straw poll to be the de facto results of the Iowa caucuses. And that'll keep her campaign going. Other than that, there's nothing other than insanity going on here.
Well, I'm just going to observe, Greg, first of all, under the new front-loaded schedule, because everybody has to move back, you know, successive weeks in relation to Florida and now in relation to New Hampshire, the Iowa caucuses were now actually held last week. that's where they are on the calendar. You know, basically neutrinos will be the only one who will get to vote because they actually can move back in time according to the latest physics experiments, et cetera. So there's that, you know, fascinating aspect of it all. The other one is, however you're doing right now, you kind of want it to, you know, all right, let's get the voting starting already. Apparently, if you're Iowa, you know, it's kind of like the Colonial Minutemen. You have to be ready to vote in a minute because here it is. It's mid-October, and we don't really know when these votes are going to be held. Needless to say, I think it's a terrible idea, Greg. And I got to tell you, if the New Hampshire primary is held on December 6th, that will be a day that will live in. Okay, actually, that's the next day. It's a day that will live in infamy. But it'll be a day that will live in irritation or something like that. But it you know, part of me in my, you know, it's such a crazy idea. I'm almost thinking, this can't really happen. At some point, Reince Priebus or somebody's going to step in and say, whoa. All right, here's how it's going to work. Iowa, your first week in January. New Hampshire, your second week. Nevada, your third week. South Carolina, you're fourth. Sorry, Florida. I mean, you know, South Carolina, you're fourth. Florida, you got to move it. I don't care how much your state wants to do it this way. Your first week of February. And that's, you know, like we almost need, Greg, we need a benevolent dictator when it comes to the primary. We need a benevolent dictator, and Reince Priebus is the man to do it. You know, the gargantuan, booming voice of Reince Priebus.
I know. I was so looking forward to this actually starting in February. It made me think, you know, harken back to the old days when things like that actually happened. And then Florida had to jump the line. I was just hoping, you know, that maybe Priebus or some of these other, even the candidates, would basically do like they did 4 years ago, ignore them, have their delegate total or something, and just basically make it completely untenable for them to actually do this. The idea that being fifth or sixth in line makes you somehow irrelevant in the process is just stupid, because if you look at 2008, Florida was really the contest that sealed it for John McCain. It was after that that Mitt Romney eventually bowed out shortly after that at the CPAC conference, and after that it was just kind of mop-up duty against Mike Huckabee and Ron Paul. So the idea that if you're not first in line or one of the first two or three is just wrong, and for them to upset the whole apple cart is just going to make everybody angry at them. But Florida, just vote Republican in the fall, and we'll all be happy with you.
Otherwise, we could very easily turn. You could become the new Nevada.
That's
way
right.
To go, Florida. Way to go.
Exactly. Well, New Hampshire is a small state that has a very important role in the political process. Another state of similar size that got a lot of attention in the 2010 cycle was Delaware, largely because one of the Tea Party candidates, Christine O'Donnell, scored a major upset win in the primary against Mike Castle, the longtime moderate to liberal congressman from that state. But it was a statewide congressional seat, so the establishment thought he'd be a pretty good Senate candidate. In the end, she ended up winning the nomination, then ended up being pretty solidly defeated by Chris Coons in the Senate race. Well, Christine O'Donnell has since written a book called Troublemaker, and she's apparently just scored another contract for another book, Jim. But you've been looking at some of the data that suggests that apparently the bar for getting a second book deal isn't quite as high as it used to be.
The numbers I'm citing for you are from August 31st. So it's conceivable that at some point in the past 6 weeks or so, there's been some sort of uptick in the sales of Christine O'Donnell's book. But, you know, the chances of that being that dramatic are not that great. So Christine O'Donnell gets this book, best known for running for Senate and not winning, and then running for Senate and not winning again. So apparently the total sales were, at least as of the end of August, were 2,200, which is pretty darn modest, even by the standards of political books, et cetera, et cetera. The other intriguing thing is that of this, 1,500 were sold in supporters to the home state in Delaware, and arguably to parts of her PAC, suggesting that, you know, that really when you talk about, you know, people at Barnes & Noble or other bookstores, et cetera, only 700 copies were sold, which is pretty darn bad. The other fascinating detail is that the audio version sold 12 copies, I am informed. Now, this means, Greg, that they send out promotional copies to folks hoping to get reviews, et cetera. The total number of copies of the audio version sent to me are roughly 8 to 9% of the number of sold copies of the audio version. I received one, they sold 12. A pretty low standard. It's often been speculated that those who get political book deals are not really, you know, publishers aren't really thinking about profits. They aren't really thinking about these things. They're almost public services or political figure charity acts. And oh, by the way, I just want to preface this by saying, if somebody wants to say, hey, Jim Garrity is the absolute last guy to mock other people for writing books that don't sell well, that's not the most unreasonable criticism I've ever heard. Having said that, I'm not nearly as well known as Christine O'Donnell was, and I learned from my wonderful experience, you know what? You really don't want to come out with a book the same month as Mark Stein and Bill O'Reilly and Bob Woodward and Pervez Musharraf, the ruler of Pakistan. At one point, I said to my publisher, what do I have to do to get more publicity from you guys, take over Pakistan in a coup? And they said, no, one of our other authors already did that. So lessons in book publishing that sometimes it's a dog-eat-dog world. I suppose we should say congratulations to Christine O'Donnell. I just think, you know, getting more sales is probably going to require a little bit of, what's the term I'm looking for, Greg? Witchcraft? Magic? Focus, focus?
Have a great day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Friday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.